seconds or so. Roger, we didn't get it, so please repeat that last transmission. K2JIS in Florida. K2RIW in the TechNav.
Good thing for him to do. All right, now, let me question. Science. Let it drop. Young gentleman is asking that up at the North Pole region where the aurora happens, understands that it's high energy particles that are being pulled in magnetic field, and he wants to know about the hazard. Is hazard, can that be measured, and how active is it? What do you know about that, Dick? Back to you, sir. AC2WGB.
Yeah, the sun is squirting out a continuous solar wind. There's a whole bunch of charged particles coming out of the sun. Quite often they're coming out of the sun at around a million miles an hour. And when there's a solar prominence, when there's a sunspot on the sun, with local magnetic fields, and sometimes it's literally an explosion on the sun, a great big burst of these solar wind particles, you know, 10 or 100 times or 1,000 times normal strength, come suddenly blasting in some direction in Earth, in some direction out into space. The sun rotates something like once every 27 days, so that particular chunk of sun that's doing this erupting, whether it is aimed toward us or whether it's aimed away from us as the sun rotates, determines whether or not that great big blast hits the Earth. If you're in space, if you and I were traveling between Earth and Mars, for instance, or between Earth and the Moon, and a major solar prominence occurs, those charged particles at extremely high velocity do represent a radiation hazard. So if you're in space, they definitely represent a radiation hazard. When you're under the Earth's atmosphere, inside of the Earth's magnetic field, you're safe as all hell from this stuff. In other words, it gets attenuated by probably a million to one. Those charged particles coming out of the sun, let me drop them. Depending on whether those charged particles are positive or negative, as they approach the Earth, they will favor the North Pole or the South Pole, and the so-called Van Allen belt is really where these charged particles get trapped in the Earth's magnetic field, and they're bouncing back and forth between the North Pole and the South Pole. That's one of the explanations as to what is all of that material in the so-called Van Allen belt around the Earth. And if you, as an astronaut on the International Space Station, dwelled in that Van Allen belt for a significant period of time, you would be getting a significant amount of radiation. Therefore, the International Space Station is flying a very narrow path between being high enough up where you're not experiencing significant atmospheric drag, and yet low enough where you're below the Van Allen belt if you're not being cooked. So those charged particles, when they hit the atmosphere, and whether or not they hit nitrogen or oxygen or hydrogen, depending on which of the particles of the atmosphere they're hitting, determines what color of the glow you get for the aurora borealis or the aurora australis. So those aurora are where these charged particles are hitting the atmosphere and creating that glow. But by a million to one, those particles don't get through that magnetic field, don't get through that atmosphere. So down here, we're safe as all hell. Let me drop. So as you can see, that when it comes to a planet like Mars, where Mars is like one-half the diameter of the Earth, at the outer fringe of the Goldilocks zone, it's quite far away from the sun, so it gets less sunlight. Being a smaller planet, it cooled off more rapidly. The core of the planet cooled off and probably is no longer liquid. It's the liquid core of the Earth and the motion of that liquid core that's believed to be the major cause of the magnetic field. So we've got this beautiful magnetic field that gives us a lot of protection. Mars does not have any very much of a magnetic field, almost none at all. Therefore, it's getting very little protection of this kind. Therefore, the solar wind hitting Mars's atmosphere is continuously peeling away that atmosphere and sending those atmospheric particles somewhere out in space as these high-power bullets, so to speak, come out of the sun. That's part of the reason why almost no atmosphere exists on Mars, almost no magnetic field exists on Mars. Let me drag it. So an astronaut standing on the surface of Mars is going to be getting almost the full effect of the solar wind. He's going to be irradiated continuously by that solar wind, by cosmic rays. Also the cosmic rays from space hit our atmosphere, and 99% of them get stopped, if you know what I mean. So standing on Mars, you're going to be hit with cosmic rays, you're going to be hit with solar winds, you're going to be hit with meteorites and asteroids and anything else that comes down, because there's so little atmosphere there. And that's part of the things that were not quite accurate in the movie called The Martian. Darn good movie, but there's a couple of inaccuracies there. And so on Mars, you get some ridiculously cold evenings, like minus 200, minus 300 degrees Fahrenheit temperature at nighttime. And here you had Matt Damon sleeping under the vehicle under those kind of temperatures with very little local atmosphere. And where did all the oxygen come from that was feeding his spacesuit and his residence? I mean, every time you go through an airlock and you pressurize the hold-on residence, you're giving away all of that oxygen that used to be there. Those details were not very well covered in that movie. So he had an infinite supply of oxygen, didn't have to worry about it. All he had to worry about is food and water, as far as the movie is concerned. KC2WGB, K2IW.net.
He's, well, at least we know he's safe if he goes up there and tries to experience it. But I do have one question. Background particle count, do you think it...
I'm not sure. And if it did, the amount of background count would it be... there's a couple of articles these days, particularly in the website giving you space weather, where these very progressive students in California are launching very high altitude balloons with Geiger counters, recording Geiger counters on the balloon. And one of the things that's really strange is that as the balloon goes higher and higher in the atmosphere, you see the background count, you see the cosmic ray count significantly increase as they go up to higher and higher altitudes. However, there's a strange effect that occurs where you get the maximum Geiger counter count at roughly 60,000 feet. As you go to higher altitudes, the count goes to lower numbers. And if a man's name is associated with that, starts with a P, not an easy name to pronounce, as I remember. Anyhow, if you go to that space weather website, you'll see the curve that they drew as a function of altitude and counts of their Geiger counter. And they also are measuring temperature and atmospheric pressure. And then you see this the curve go up to a maximum number and then start dipping back down as they go to higher altitudes. And part of the explanation is that many of these particles that come into the Earth's atmosphere at extremely high velocities, let me drop them. As soon as they start striking the upper atmospheric particles, air particles, they create a whole shower of secondary particles. So the total number of particles increases. One cosmic ray particle hitting our atmosphere might create, I'm going to pick a number out of here, 10 or 100 individual secondary particles that are still at high velocity. And it's those secondary particles that are recording on your Geiger counter. And that's part of the explanation where as you go to higher altitudes than 60,000 feet, the count starts going back down. That doesn't mean above 60,000 feet is safer. Astronauts have experience. Anybody in space, if his eyes are sensitive enough and he's looking for the effect, at nighttime with his eyes closed, he will see flashes of light. As these cosmic ray particles penetrate the side of his spacecraft, go through his head, go through his eye, and go roaring out the other side. And they leave a streak in the fluid of your eye called Cherenkov radiation. When a particle is moving faster than the speed of light for that particular medium, it gives off a streak of light. So the astronauts will very frequently see streaks of light in the dark when their eyes are dark adapted and their eyes are closed.
How dangerous is that?
Okay. There is a Veritasium article on that exact subject, which I bring to your attention. Let's see now. That sounds like Barry. Barry, N2MB, if you go to that Veritasium article where what Greg Mueller did was to take a rather sensitive Geiger counter to various places on Earth, like like Hiroshima and the place where they first tested an atomic bomb, and at various altitudes in an airplane. He actually measured the amount of radiation you can be exposed to in various environments. So it turns out that a astronaut on the International Space Station is getting a much higher amount of dose of radiation than you and I are on the face of the Earth. And as such, an astronaut spending a lot of time in space has a calculatable amount of increase in the probability of him developing a cancer. I think the actual numbers are not really high, but there's a calculatable amount of increase in probability when you're an astronaut. And to Mike Bravo, K2RIW and TechNet, you've got a Barry.
I can't keep it for long because I'm in the car, but what you're telling me is it's a calculatable increase, but it's not necessarily something that you should be very worried about.
If you were dwelling for a lot of time in space on, say, for instance, the International Space Station, you're going to be subjected to an awful lot of things you've got to worry about. The background radiation is a factor. Not a big one, but it's a factor. The rate at which you lose bone mass is a factor. No matter how much exercise you do, your bones are not being cyclically loaded every hour of every day like they are on Earth, and therefore your body starts adapting, saying, I don't need as much calcium, those bones don't need as much strength, your bones are continuously becoming weaker, your muscles are becoming weaker, your body chemistry is slightly changing, your blood pressure of your head versus your feet is changing. There's a hell of a lot of effects that you are going to experience. Not all of them, very few of them are desirable when you spend a lot of time in space. I'm not so sure that you and I would want to volunteer for that right away once we knew all of the facts. At 2MB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, I got to get back to my driving. Thanks for answering that, Nick. I appreciate it. I think what you're saying is, in the future, we should make a space station like a big wheel, like they once discussed, spin it, and then the guys inside it will feel gravity, and their bones won't deteriorate so much. That's what it sounds like. Back over to TechNet and 2MB Mobile.
Yeah, in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, the major space station around the Earth was a great big spinning wheel. And once you can create artificial gravity, the loss in bone mass, the loss in muscle mass, you're correcting for that. But you're still going to have the cosmic ray problem, the nuclear radiation problem. There's a hell of a lot of particles zipping through space because one light year and 50 light years, 50,000 light years, and a couple of billion light years away, Mother Nature is doing something. Black holes are colliding. Black holes and neutron stars are being created. All kinds of things are making gamma ray bursts and bursts of particles and whatever. And to try to shield from that is very difficult. The nicest shield in the world is 6 miles of thickness of Earth's atmosphere. That's a very good shield. And you try to create that amount of shielding by way of lead walls, boy, those lead walls are going to have to be awfully thick. And to put that much weight of lead in space in order to protect you from radiation, there's some strong disadvantages of doing that. That's going to be kind of expensive. I don't think anybody has created any other method of protecting a human being from cosmic rays. These particles are moving at such high velocity that to stop them requires a lot of thickness of massive materials. Do you know of any better way of doing that, Wes? And 2XJN, I'll keep it a little bit brief, Wes, because we have trouble understanding your language, your pronunciations. And 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I have a translator. And it's John. BC2WCP. Anyhow, that the article that you're quoting specify what is understood by radiation. It's, for me, sounds like you have seen all kind of different animals. What animals? Good radiation. Every radiation is different, has different frequency, different features, different speech, moves different, a little wiggle. Enter a ship.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, Wes, and that is there's various kinds of radiation. The solar wind is one kind of radiation. Cosmic rays are another kind of radiation. Gamma ray bursts are another kind of radiation. So there's various kinds of particles themselves. The particles themselves can be protons, neutrons, electrons, positrons. They tend to be moving at very high velocities. You measure their energy in the millions of electron volts, thousands of millions of electron volts. So you can measure their energy, and by various techniques, you can measure their polarity and make a good guess as to whether or not what kind of a particle. But when it comes to particles of radiation, there's many kinds. And almost all of them, when they penetrate a human being, create some kind of damage because particles versus waves. When the energy gets high enough, most kinds of energy being transmitted acts like a particle. Those are microscopic bullets penetrating your skin, and as they penetrate, they have the calculatable probability of changing the code of your DNA, and as such, they can create a cancer, among other grief. The good news about radiation is that it tends to increase the rate of evolution, the rate at which a species will change, if you're willing to wait half a million generations, so to speak. So an awful lot of the evolution of human beings is believed to have been partially created by radiation. But for the most part, radiation is bad, and you should be trying to avoid it. Let me drop a super conservative person worrying about radiation will say that every dose is an overdose. And that's a little bit too strong. Turns out there's a risk-to-benefit ratio of everything you do. So no matter what kind of an experiment you're doing, if there's radiation involved, when it comes to nuclear radiation, which for the most part is accumulative, you give a person a certain number of microsieverts of radiation yesterday and a similar number of microsieverts of radiation today, you add those two numbers together, and that comes pretty close to the total dosage. In the case of RF radiation, which really should be called RF transmission or RF signaling, the energy of each one of those particles, so to speak, is so low that it does not accumulate. You expose a human being to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter of RF yesterday and 1 milliwatt per square centimeter of RF today, the total dosage you've given him is very close to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. It doesn't accumulate because it's not individual particles that are creating damage as they penetrate. RF radiation only creates heating. After 60 years of studying it, they haven't found any non-thermal effects. They only found the thermal effects. So if the RF energy you're being exposed to is low enough, if it's below the maximum permitted exposure, which really means that the watts per kilogram is below a certain number of heating capability, then it's relatively safe. So for people who worry about, let me drop it again. They think their cell phone is creating cancer. I doubt it very highly. They think the nearest cell site is creating cancer. Particularly doubly doubtful, because the closest you can get to a cell site at drive time, when it's at maximum performance, at rush hour, so to speak, in 1 million times lower than the amount of RF energy you get from that cell phone held up against your head because of the inverse square law. We're talking about a half inch of spacing versus 200 feet of spacing. The word radiation, boy, there's a zillion kinds of it. That's sort of what Wes is talking to us about. And yes, if you really want to figure out how dangerous, you've got to find out which kind are we talking about. And there's lots of kinds of it. I know we're getting a little bit off subject, but maybe this is somewhat helpful. I'm not an expert in this subject. I'm telling you what I read and what people tell me. KC2WGB, KTRIW in the TechNet.
KTJ2WGB. Very good, Dick. All right. Yeah, radiation, when you look at it, whether it's emission of heat or light or RF energy, there's so many terms that radiation covers. It's unfortunate they use that term. nuclear radiation is just something we have to live with today, unfortunately. All right, let me drop out and go on to the next question.
Yeah, stand by a little bit. We just heard from Roger. Roger has come back online. K2JAS in Florida. K2RIW. Go ahead, Roger.
Okay, this is K2JAS. And the question I have had to do with being at the North or South Pole, where it seems that all of this radiation is ducted down towards. Is it more hazardous to be in that environment of the poles for exposure to this kind of solar radiation? Back to you, Dick.
I'm not positive on this one, Roger, but I think the answer is no. That atmosphere that's above you and me, which has got roughly 6 miles of major area of density, 6 miles thickness, that does such a beautiful job. The total number of molecules that's in each cubic centimeter of air is such a huge number. And now those cosmic rays have to go through lots and lots of miles of that atmosphere to get down to you. By the time they've been through all of that stuff, even though that atmosphere is thoroughly transparent on a clear day, as far as your and my eyesight is concerned, it is an extremely opaque object to cosmic rays. So I think if you had a very accurate Geiger counter and you went to the North Pole during a major aurora display and then you drove back down to Port St. Lucie, Florida with that exact same Geiger counter, I think you'd have trouble seeing the difference. I think the background radiation reading in the North Pole, maybe it's going to be higher, but maybe it's going to be 2% higher, if you know what I mean. That atmosphere does such a beautiful job. That display that you're seeing of the aurora lighting up the sky, that display is occurring, I don't know the exact number, but it's something like 50 kilometers above you. That's where those atmospheric, that's where the solar wind particles are hitting the atmosphere and giving off light. Those particles are being stopped and giving off that light 30 kilometers above you. You're under another 30 kilometers of atmosphere, and so the amount that gets down to you, I think, is very little different. That's my guess, and we've got to do a little bit more research on that, but I think you'd have trouble making that measurement because that atmosphere has such a beautiful job of shielding us. K2JAS in Florida. K2RI.
Repeater. Time out.
Okay, this is K2JAS. Thank you for that, Dick. My only concern here was that if you look at the diagrams, the flux lines, the magnetic field flux lines converging at the pole seem to duct the charged particles from the sun down towards the poles, and it would by ducting, it tends to concentrate them in that area, so that's why I had the assumption that exposure would be so much greater at the poles. But of course, I could be wrong. Thank you for letting me in here, and now back to you, and time to change the subject.
WS2N.
Yeah, we're going to pick up Paul in a minute. The cosmic ray particles from space, due to gamma ray bursts and things like that, have such huge amounts of energy. Those particles are moving a very large fraction of the speed of light. As such, when they hit the atmosphere, they create secondary and tertiary other particles that are still moving very fast. And that's the majority of the cosmic ray radiation you and I get down here on Earth. Solar wind particles, we think they're moving very fast. They're moving close to a million miles an hour. Well, a million miles an hour is very slow compared to cosmic ray particles. And the reason they're lighting up the aurora atmosphere is because there's a large number of them being funneled by way of the magnetic field, and they're hitting the atmosphere 30 kilometers up and giving them lighting. But those are rather low energy particles compared to cosmic rays. So their nuclear radiation capability of doing damage to you is much, much smaller, particularly after the atmosphere. Yes, if you and I in space, now there's a lot of them, even though they're relatively low in energy, there's a large number of them, in space, they could give you some grief. But, Paul, you probably have read quite a few articles by NASA on this subject. Let's see what you'd like to add to this. WS2N, our space expert, KGRI, W in the TechNet. You've got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. The point I wanted to bring up is the poles are not really exactly where that magnetic field is in line with the axis. It's about 11 degrees off, so it is stronger in the pole area, but it just doesn't get all the way down to the Earth. But the bottom is there, and that's why you're going to get the aurora borealis. Same thing on the south pole. But once they get into the Van Allen belts, they're supposed to be traveling. You know, they'll travel away from the poles. They'll travel all the way down to the south pole and back and forth. They get themselves trapped in there. And because of that 11-degree tilt, that's what I want to bring up. They have the South Atlantic anomaly. And a lot of satellites, Earth-orbiting satellites, LEO satellites, they try to keep it away from that area, whatever, how many degrees south of the equator it is. They'll adjust their inclination to try to, you know, I mean, they're going to hit it, but they try to keep it to a minimum. It is a problem, again, in space, but it is lower at that point because of that tilt, that 11-degree tilt from the axis. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, my understanding of why the Van Allen belt is dangerous is not because the particles in the Van Allen belt are extremely high in velocity and energy content per particle. What makes the Van Allen belt dangerous is because there's a darn many of the particles there. There's a huge density of what I think are primarily solar wind particles bouncing back and forth between North Pole and the South Pole, following the magnetic lines of force around the Earth. So Van Allen belt is dangerous not because of energy, but because of the large number. Cosmic rays coming in from space have got a huge amount of energy, but thank goodness they're much lower in number. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, this huge device that was put on the International Space Station to measure these particles, is above the atmosphere where you can measure them before they become secondary particles after hitting the atmosphere and become more difficult to analyze what they originally were. Let me drop it. But that Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is put there for a couple of reasons. Almost everything we've put in space before, to measure cosmic ray particles, periodically you're going to get a burst of particles that saturates your meter. Almost everything we put into space in the past didn't really measure the complete intensity, because occasionally the meter gets saturated. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer has got a much higher peak reading capability, and when you start reading those high peak readings with a local very strong magnetic field, by which you can determine by the curve of the path, you can measure the direction of arrival and whether or not the particles are charged, and they're suddenly discovering a significant number of positrons, positively charged electrons, that suggest that they came from antimatter somewhere in space. You could, if you want to, start speculating that all of our local galaxies are ordinary matter, but maybe there's a galaxy out there that's issuing particles that's really a galaxy made out of antimatter. I mean, this is a great big mystery. At the Big Bang, we thought there's going to be an equal amount of matter and antimatter. And yet all the measurements we make tell us that the most dominant material, let me drop this, the most dominant material that we can see and measure is a positive matter, not antimatter. But you put the right kind of detector in space and you start measuring a certain number of antimatter particles that you never expected to see. And now you can start coming up with all kinds of speculations as to what is that data telling you. There's a message there. I'm not sure we've really interpreted that message yet. That's an opinion. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Wow, you know, these young guys writing these questions, that was an interesting question about those particles. He doesn't have to worry if he goes up to the North Pole. People have survived before. All right, got a question that came in on the chat room here. Maybe somebody can help this gentleman. Call sign KD2, Golf Uniform Zed. He's questioning a Palomar antenna. Palomar Engineering made an antenna, loop antenna. It has 5 loops. Maybe Hal, if he's listening, would know. The company went out of business. He'd like to know how he could go about repairing that antenna. I have no other information than that. Does anybody have any information on that company or how to check out that antenna? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
First of all, John, what do we know about the antenna? Is it HF, VHF, UHF? Is it a dipole-like, ground plane-like? What do we know about this Palomar antenna? Over to you, John.
Nothing other than it has 5 loops, it's a loop antenna, and that's about it. It was working perfectly, and now it's not working. It's not a complicated device, so I've never heard of that company. I don't have any idea what this antenna looks like, or the frequency it covers, Dick. Evidently, it covers a couple of bands with several loops, but I thought maybe you have known the company or heard about it.
Okay, there's a series of articles that Rich K2
UPS.
That's the guy, KTUPS has brought to our attention a number of articles about loop antennas that cover 80, 40, 20 individual loop antennas covering each one of those bands. And I've looked at a number of these articles, beautiful devices that are nice and compact. Ordinarily an 80 meter dipole antenna would be 132 feet long. Might make it out of 14 gauge wire and put it to 40 feet in the air. It takes some real estate to establish that antenna, but the antenna works very well. You can get almost equal performance out of a multi-turn loop antenna that might be 4 or 5 feet in diameter. And because of the magic of resonance, that statement that I think is very important, you resonate first, then you can radiate. So as long as you've made a loop that will hit resonance at your favorite frequency, 3.75 megs, 14.1 megs, and so on, as long as it hits resonance at your frequency, and you can, and if you're smart enough to make a reasonably good impedance match into that loop, and then once again you've made it at a low loss materials, you're going to get nearly full performance. So you can make an antenna that's 4 foot square out of multi-turns of loop, and it has almost the identical performance of a 132-foot long chunk of wire 30 feet in the air. Once the circuit resonates, it will radiate. And so these loop antennas, the main thing that has to happen is it must hit resonance. Let me drop it.
Dickie just wrote in, it's an HF only.
And that correlates with what Richard told us, K2UPS. These are HF antennas, compact HF loop-like antennas. So that the main thing that's required is for the loop itself to hit resonance. That resonance usually consists of, in the case of an 80-meter loop, it might be 5 individual turns. And whether or not they're closely spaced or wide-spaced, these are individual designs, minor variations, got very little to do with the performance. You can make the turns laying on top of each other if you want to. Although, now you've got a little bit of a problem of that as the turns change their spacing, it will change the tuning. But the main thing that brings that loop antenna into resonance is the air variable capacitor that connects the very beginning of the 5 turns versus the very last turn of the 5 turns. Between those two is an air variable capacitor, usually transmitting grade capacitor if you can put more than a watt into the thing, because it does give you a very large voltage buildup. You can easily get 10,000 volts across that capacitor if you're putting, let's say, 50 watts into that antenna. So if it no longer radiates, if it no longer resonates, then the first thing I would look for is whether or not that capacitor has had some kind of a failure. Let me drop it. If your particular design requires that capacitor hit, let me pick a number, 25 picofarads, and if for some reason you've lost some of the plates and it can only go to 15 picofarad today, or because a piece of material has been deposited between the plates and now the plates are not a capacitor, it's a short circuit. That that whole loop antenna. The most important thing is that that capacitor must be at the right number of picofarads and not shorted out and not an open circuit. The solder connection to that capacitor must be there. No short turns, no short circuit across it, and the right number of picofarads across that number of turns of coil. Once that coil resonates, you're essentially home free. The other in your coaxial connector and that small loop that feeds it, make sure that the solder connection hasn't broken there. So by visual inspection, you should be able to confirm what's wrong with that kind of an antenna. Fixing it is not rocket science. In the worst case situation, if you've got a real big doubt, unsolder one of the leads of the tuning capacitor and put your own meter across it to make sure it's not a short circuit. So by visual inspection and very simple testing, that antenna has got to be brought back into operation, because it doesn't contain any magic materials from my point of view, John. You just got to make sure it hits resonance. And whether or not it hits resonance could be confirmed with Hal's favorite test equipment, a grid tip oscillator. But your antenna tuner, your antenna analyzer, your Vizwa detecting devices, there's all kinds of ways you can find out whether or not the antenna is working. Let me drop.
I just got a note from Rich on Echolink that Palomar is still in business. So he might have more information on it, but that's a good thing. And I agree, it should be a very simple thing to find. But this is a new call sign, so there may be issues there.
Yeah, KD2GAS, James, Old Bridge, New Jersey. It's a new call sign. For all we know, he's been around a while, John. But I think he should be able to fix it. Guarantee a visual inspection is going to find 90% of the possible errors. I don't think you have to go back to the manufacturer to fix that. I think he should be able to fix it. That's my opinion, John. There's no rocket science in there. Once you recognize the theory of operation is an impedance matching loop, a small loop, feeding the multi-turn loop that must resonate. By the way, whether or not it doesn't work, before you completely give up on it, if, for instance, it's an 80-meter loop antenna, do the test at the low end of the band, 3.5 megs, the middle of the band, 3.75, the high end of the band, 3.95, if you know what I mean. If there's something funny about your capacitor that it doesn't hit the right value, but you can make it resonate at somewhere in that band while going through the range of that capacitor, that's going to give you a lot of clues. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Kilo Delta. Bravo Delta. Mesa.
I believe someone's trying to get in, Dick, but it's a little bad copy there. All right. Well, that's good news, and I agree with you. More than likely, it's going to be passenger if it's not functioning on most of those bands. Apparently, it's not working at all. I think a few ohmmetric checks, plus checking that capacitor, if it's shorted, there's an issue right there. That may be still available from the manufacturer, or you might be able to sub it. You should try to pick up that other station. And that's it from the mailbag, Dick, and we'll go over to Ballistitis. Back to you, KC2WGB.
There was a person trying to sign in, but he was dropping out of the machine, and we only heard KD2. So I'm going to try again. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Bravo.
Okay, you're dropping out of the machine, possibly due to overdeviation. Try speaking much softer. We heard a K, we heard a 2, and we heard a Bravo. That's all we heard with a whole lot of dropouts. Give it another try. K2RIW. Once again, that was 80% dropout. I heard the word loop antenna. I can tell you're trying to ask us a question about a loop antenna. Is there anything you can do to aim the antenna a little bit better at the repeater, give us a little bit more power, speak a little softer? As you talk, you drop out of the machine. Give it one more try. K2LIW in the TechNet.
About a year ago, this month. So they're getting back on track, but they're utilizing the Atlas V rocket instead of their own Antares rocket that they were using for the Cygnus resupply missions. So they've hired United Launch Alliance, which really consists of Boeing and Lockheed, who fly all the Delta and Atlas rockets to get them to put Cygnus supply craft on top of their rocket. Now the good news is for the space station, the Cygnus is a new enhanced version. They have solar panels that are much lighter than the old ones. They look quite different. They open up like a fan, 2 12 diameter fan-like solar panels instead of the ones that fold out. They generate about the same amount of power, about 4 kilowatts, but much lighter, much stronger, and American built instead of the ones being built by the Dutch. So that'll be the next launch. Then they have another launch. They also bought into another Atlas launch of early next year to launch a similar enhanced spacecraft, Cygnus spacecraft. It's also much longer, so instead of carrying their, 5,000 pounds, it's carrying the 7,500 pounds, more than the Progress resupply ships. And that'll be the end of the contract with Boeing and Lockheed, the United Launch Alliance. And they've got their own Antares rocket, which should be ready by March, maybe even March or April. And when they start launching that, they'll launch future enhanced Cygnus spacecraft up to the space station from Wallops Island, Virginia, not too far from here, about 400 miles. As the crow flies, we'll be able to get to see those launches on clear nights. So that's always fun. And that will be able to carry the same amount of cargo, even though the old rockets carried less. These are going to be new rockets with different engines, more powerful engines than the old Russian engines that they were using. Old Russian engines. Now they're using newer, upgraded Russian engines for the time being. And WWR track is coming early this year, 2016. You're always interested in the Chinese space stations. Dick, let me drop it. They held a meeting, and they actually held it in Israel. Had a meeting there to different countries interested in the space program. They're trying to get a couple of other countries to sign on with them because they plan on sending up increasing modules for their space station. The Tiangong 1, that was their test one. They're finished with that one, and now they're going to be going with the Tiangong 2. And that will consist of at least probably 5 or 6 modules, 3 of which will be part of China. And then they're looking to get a couple of other countries to sign on with them. And it looks like it's a version of the Mir space station. So, their first core launch will be 2018 for the Tiangong space station. And right around that time, they have a new supply vehicle that they're building. For instance, right now we have supply built vehicles going up to the space station. You've got the Cygnus that I mentioned. You've got the Progress spacecraft. You've got the H-2 by Japan, all supplying the space station, as well as the Dragon by SpaceX. Well, China has right now no resupply vehicles until now. That will be ready in 2018. So they'll be able to supply their own space station. And hopefully we get extensions on on our space station. Because right now we're good until 2024. Japan hasn't signed up yet for that 2024 number, but hopefully they will. Russians have, European Space Station, European Space Agency has not signed up as well, but they're expected to. But I'd like to see it go beyond 2024, and probably will, I think. Let me drop it. And that's pretty much it for now. I mean, China's gung-ho, but so is Russia, so is the European Space Station, Space Agency. They've gotten together, and within 5 years, they're going to have space vehicles landing on the south pole of the moon. And they have definite plans of creating a base there. It has been talked about for decades, of course. Now they plan on really going ahead with this. I've read some preliminary plans too, dealing with that, and to be able to have a base on the southern pole of the moon, which gets light 99% of the time. They're up in these high mountain regions, and yet down in the craters, they've already proven that there's ice water down there that they can get mined out of the crater. So be looking forward to a lot of different launches, interesting things between the moon and, of course, Mars. We drop it. Now we're back to Mars. Best movie I've seen in a long time, Dick. The Martian. Very well done. I was impressed by it. You know, I had a guide to go by because, you know, a couple of years ago when the book first came out, I read the book. And so naturally, I'm comparing the two as I'm watching the movie. I think they did a great job. Back to you, Dick, KTRW. This is WS2N for the Space Report. You're right, 171.
Thank you, Paul. And in the movie, The Martian, they did bring China into it. In other words, China had a booster that was made use of at a critical period to save the astronaut. Supply food to him at the right time. But the fact that we don't know too much about China's space capability was part of the plot of the movie. It did a lot of special effects, and there really is a story. I don't know why in the world the newspaper reviewers thought that, yeah, there's lots of technical stuff, but there was no story there. From the point of view of my family who saw the movie today, there's lots of story there. There were a couple of places in the movie, though, where details were not quite accurate. Let me drop it. You're led to believe that his only real problem for surviving, he was left by mistake on Mars, and he had to survive for a significant number of hundreds of days until a rescue mission was possible. And he led you to believe his only problem was food and water. And they completely glossed over all of the oxygen he needed. I mean, he's going in and out of that airlock, pressurizing the whole darn habitable structure that he was living in. So he's venting all the air in the structure out, opening the door, going outside, coming back in, and initiating the atmosphere in the structure. Completely forget about the fact that where was all that atmosphere coming from? Very little atmosphere on Mars. And he's repressurizing all of these vehicles time and time again and not worrying about that detail. And when his habitable structure became damaged because of an explosion that he created, he then covers it over with a piece of plastic, a great big port. I mean, you and I were discussing a couple of weeks ago how much pressure exists across these, I think we decided it was, 54-inch square hole in between the modules of the International Space Station. Let me drop it. And they have a very large number of very high-strength bolts around the perimeter.